I'm going to start. My name is Susan Leopold. I'm the Executive Director of United Plant Savers. United Plant Savers is an organization, a nonprofit that was started in 1994, so it's almost 20 years old. It was really a gathering of the minds. It was herbalists who were meeting at the International Herb Symposium right when herbalism was really starting to take off. And they were concerned about the cost of some of the wild plants. And they were concerned that with such an increase in cost that these plants were vulnerable and being over-harvested from the wild. So United Plant Savers was really formed a group of people, herbalists, owners of large herb companies at the time, that really wanted to set a precedent with the conservation of native medicinal herbs in North America. And that's where UPS got started. A few years after it got off the ground, the board of directors decided what would be most helpful to guide the herb industry and to guide herbalists would be to come up with an at-risk list of native medicinal plants. So an at-risk list came together and a to-watch list. So after a few years of having this list, and the herb companies starting to adopt this list, and other people starting to become more aware about the list, they really, questions came up again at the board: how do we validate this at-risk list? How do we scientifically stand behind whether these plants are at risk or not at risk? And so then the discussion came up of an at-risk tool. And this tool has been in the works, and Lisa's going to go more into it. But the tool has been in the making nearly a decade, so it just hasn't happened overnight. This is a long journey, and there's still more ahead of it. But I want to highlight one thing. United Plant Savers, the reason why the tool is so critical is because in the medicinal plant world, it's really driven by consumer demands, and every day you're hearing about a new medicinal plant that's on the horizon that's going to be the new superfood or it's going to be the cure-all. So the medicinal plant industry and conservation of native medicinal plants, those plants that are being harvested from the wild, not cultivated, we need to be able to react with a certain level of rapid reaction if we're concerned about a plant, because it doesn't take much to over-harvest a plant to the rate of extinction. And I bring up the story of sandalwood. Sandalwood is a globally rare species. There's several species of sandalwood. And there is one species, Santalum paniculatum, that only grows on the Big Island of Hawaii. UPS found out that very small remnant populations were being logged, and it was critical to act in regards, because you can imagine, we know Hawaii endemicism. I mean, we're a very small area, very small population, a tree that takes 60 years to mature before you can harvest it. When you harvest it, you dig up the roots. So, the regeneration is not going to react well to, logging. And so we used our tool. It scored very high. We decided as a board to add sandalwood to our at-risk list. And we've been working really hard to educate the public about sandalwood in Hawaii. And we've been working with state and federal agencies. And we've really used the tool as a talking point. And so we hope that the tool will get out there. We'll get feedback from people. And we hope to see the tool be used by lots of different people. And it hit this one. So with that, I'll turn it over to Lisa.
So I came into this process in 2000 as a brand new graduate student in plant ecology, working with Kelly Kincher, who'd already been involved with United Plant Savers. And at the time, there'd always been recognition of this at-risk list as being something that was widely used, but not scientifically validated. And I immediately had questions of, why can't we just take into... I took a population ecology class. I got into matrix models. I'm like, well, surely we can quantify this if we just take, the right coefficients of population size by change in number times how much was harvested last year, and add the demand, and we'll get some magic number, and It will, I can plug it into some software and it will be wonderful. And immediately started trying to find these numbers for these plants. Like, which plants do we have a documented population size? Which plants do we have documented population changes? How many of them do we know exactly how old they are before they reproduce and how harvest affects next year's reproduction? And my Bain doctoral work ended up answering some of those questions for a species, Pedemela musculentum, prairie turnips, but started working as a side project, beware of advisors bringing side projects, for all of the rest of the species to figure out how we could make a quantitative assessment tool that was adaptable to new species. Or if information changed, how would this conservation effort affect this? To set relative priorities, you know, that there are some, there are a lot of plants that might be at risk to overharvest, but what's most at risk? Where should we, with limited time and resources, where should we focus our energy? So we started pulling up lots and lots of questions and made lists and more lists and had a committee that as a graduate student I was trying to organize, a long-distance committee, and hid a lot. Like, oh, somebody write me back. And it wasn't until we started working actually with the Blue Ocean Group, who had published one of the seafood mini-guides for which fish you should buy, and read about their process of, like, well, over-harvest of seafood is based on four distinct areas, whether the life history of the fish compared to the habitat, compared to the demand, and in their case, the bycatch. And we determined that potential for vulnerability to over-harvest for medicinal plant species could be put into five areas also. The intrinsic life history, how long-lived the plant is, and then how hard it is it to grow. How harvest affects individual plants, so what parts are used, how quickly they can recover, if they resprout, things like that. The population sizes of how populations are in the first place, the vulnerability of the habitat. Some plants themselves may not be particularly vulnerable, but are in very isolated or very vulnerable habitats. And then the demand, the market forces, how much is needed, is cultivated possible, are substitutes accepted. And we came up with questions, which you have in front of you, of those four areas. This was all done mostly in 2003, and then we met as a committee, actually met face-to-face in 2005, and revised all the questions, much to my consternation, but for the better, and got them so that they are defined what's a big range, what's large demand, and then I graduated, got a job, and there was sort of a hope that we had the tool, the plants would get scored, and other than my insisting that my students actually score plants, you can come talk to our, see my poster and learn about how that worked as a teaching tool. Not very many plants got scored until new administration at United Plant Savers says, we need to use this. And so we've been back through a process of pulling out the tool and having multiple independent people score plants using any information available. Hopefully primary and secondary sources of documented plant populations, things like that. But in many cases, there's not, you know, besides a range map, there's not good documentation. So we went as far as, you know, looking at blogs of gardeners and wildcrafters of what they saw, how much, what's changed. And then writing down what we found where. And then compiling, we had four to five of us score all of the plants that were on the original to watch and at risk list, as well as a few other sort of as an intended outgroup. And then went through a process of where there was divergence, trying to find the best documentation for current score, and completed the scores. So now we've scored 41 plants, with scores ranging from 5, low vulnerability for yarrow, so we had to have something that was not at risk so we could test, to 75 for wild harvested sandalwood on the Hawaiian Islands, so the native sandalwood. So that's our range. And Kelly Kincher will talk some about the actual tough cases and fun parts of the plants.
I'll talk about a few examples. My part will be short. It's kind of fun that Steve's already warned me on time before I speak. I like that. Yeah, do get that loop right again, because the loop is of the current at-risk medicinal plants, and these are the ones that we have scored. And, of course, I hope all the audience here has already scored a couple more species for us. Actually, it's fairly involved to do. That's why we provided the handouts. But I'm going to speak about a couple species here because I think they illustrate how this works a little bit and also some of the problems. One of the species I've worked on a lot in my career is Echinacea, so it was really fun for me to work through Echinacea on this. And Echinacea species have previously been on the at-risk list, listed as Echinacea species. So, of course, the most popular medicinal Echinacea is Echinacea angustifolia, which is mostly wild harvested. But a problem that immediately comes up, if you list a group of species, that means in this case you also have two species that have been listed as endangered or threatened federally. So, of course, those are going to rank real high, whereas you also have angustifolia that has a wide range. So what I'm going to talk about right here specifically and what we want to do with the tool is talk about individual species. So I've ranked Echinacea angustifolia, and it gets a middle rank score of a 42. So if we're in Echinacea angustifolia, the life history score is low to moderate, as although it is a long-lived perennial, it tolerates disturbance, it produces lots of seeds, and most interestingly, half of the harvested plants are able to resprout. That's some research that my crew has done over the years, Lisa helped with. The score for harvest effects on the populations of Echinacea angustifolia is high because roots are harvested for the trade, which almost kills the plant or kills at least half the plants. And then, therefore, even with sprouts, it takes years for plants to re-sprout and grow or to grow from seeds until they're large enough to harvest. Harvest is conducted almost a year round, so people are out there harvesting it all the time. And when recovery from harvest occurs, it does take this amount of time for the roots to grow. The abundant terrain score for Echinacea angustifolia is very low because many scattered populations exist over a large range of Great Plains states, from Texas all the way up to Manitoba. It can grow in many broad habitats, although some populations may be decreasing due to grazing, herbicide use, and other land management practices. The habitat vulnerability score is moderately low, as the rocky prairie habitat is widespread and not particularly threatened since the great plowing of the prairies has occurred. And generally, there's no special threats. It doesn't need special soil types or other unusual things. And the demand score is moderately high, as lots of people buy Echinacea and Echinacea angustifolia specifically. So overall, Echinacea angustifolia has only a moderate risk of being overharvested. I'll give one more example, and that's peyote. Lophophora williamsii, or peyote, is an unusual medicinal plant and is not legal for most people to harvest or possess, as it is Native American sacrament. There is considerable concern about overharvest of this plant due to its limited range, tightening of trade across the Mexican border, and growth of the Native American church, as documented by Martin Terry and others. The life history of the peyote scores high. It gets a 49. As it is a long-lived cactus that produces slowly but does not vegetatively propagate, and it tolerates some disturbance. It also scores high on the effects of its harvest do the entire plant being harvested sometimes, or at least the crown, which severely affects the plant regrowth, which takes years, at least four, as Martin Terry tells us. And the harvest season, again, is very long. As for the harvest effects on abundance and range, it has a moderately high score, as only many scattered populations exist. And although the range is large, most of it's in Mexico. And that makes the trade hard in the United States. Population declines have been documented, and it only grows in a limited habitat. And as for its habitat characteristics, its score is fairly low, and acre to habitat has not changed greatly over the last decades, and it's widespread. So overall, this is a species that appears to be at risk. We'd gladly take some questions, and we gladly encourage you to look at those score sheets later. There is a poster, and at that, Susan also will have United Plant Savers
journals. Yep. Yeah. So I encourage.
I have a question.
Yes.
Where in the Southwest is Bursera being? Where is the distribution of Bursera in the Southwest?
Far Southwest, Southern California into
the Southern California, right along the border. Then.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So there's not any in Arizona, do you know of?
Yes.
There's yes.
A little bit.
Yeah. Sierra Estrella is the northernmost.
I'm sorry?
Sierra Estrella, just south of Phoenix, is the northernmost post for...
Yeah, I know. It's usually pretty far south. The only other place I know of it is down in the Everglades. So,
okay.
Have you looked into the feasibility of using this as a predictive tool? So, obviously, climate change, here we are at the conference, that's the thing. But there's land use changes, population. It seems to me a lot you could actually plug in future values for some of these and get some cool results.
It's one of our hopes is that once we... very soon get this published, that we will be able to use it for lots of other applications. Like, okay, if we were to change this attribute, if we were to conserve the habitat, would that have any overall effect, or should we focus on changing the cultivation status? So that we could have some sort of predictive, you could model what would be the most effective, or sort of the sensitivity to different changes.
So not to say, well, I'll say it's predictive. If it got announced tomorrow that pawpaw roots are the next cure for cancer, well, we could immediately look at that score and then say, hey, what happens if you have really high demand on pawpaw tree roots? You
know, and there's another poster on the pawpaw out there, too.
So, I mean, yes, in that sense, it's very much good.
Last question.
All these are wild collected, right? So have any... way to put in the cultivator?
Yes, the cultivator does count in terms of how we deal with the issue of supply. So that is taken into account.
And that's
the ability to cultivate or being cultivated.
Mm-hmm. And that's certainly a big stand that United Plant Savers takes is we encourage conservation through cultivation. So we encourage herb companies that are going to use Golden Seal to really grow the Golden Seal if they're going to use it. So that's certainly where we hope this, you know, when we score a plant and we communicate sandalwood is being cultivated in Australia. So that's really the hope, I think, I don't think small wild populations can support large herb industry demand in this, is that
one
it?
One
was that the last question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Part of the problem if you're going to grow sandalwood in Australia is that the area that they take over, There's a large area in the tropics that has never made any money. They've tried half a dozen different crops, from sugar to rice. Now they've ended up with sandalwood. And sandalwood is basically about the only thing that they can grow there productively. And they're now seeking to expand that. Chinese are moving in there, and they want to look for crops. They're talking about growing sugar as a monoculture. This is in the wet tropics where broad-scale agriculture has been a bit of a failure, but sandalwood is seen as a pretty marginal character and not necessarily a valuable or valid use of that land.
I would also comment that cultivation is not always appropriate. Native American church members don't want greenhouse-grown peyote buttons. The echinacea market in Europe is for wild-harvested roots. People want the wild in many respects, so...
It's tricky.
Yeah, that's an amazing construct. Thank you.
Okay. Our next talk is by Dana Leposky
et al., because there's like 12 authors on this. It's Ancient Mariculture in British Columbia, Documenting the Past Before the Future.
I tax our online submission system because there's actually not that many spaces for the number of people that I work with. I just want to first just start off by thanking Steve and Vaughn for organizing this session on interdisciplinary approaches, because for me, this is the core of ethnobiology. This is what we do, and as I was saying at lunch, we are the nexus of the conversations that bring in people from all different disciplines, and we are the people that can talk to academics and to conservation people, to managers. We can talk to people on the right and the left. We can talk to people who are young and old. So this project that I'm going to be telling you about, I think HOPE is an example of that. One of the things that really struck me in the plenary session this morning was that it's a theme that really resonated with me was this idea of communities and the importance of communities and resilience and networks and sharing information in that. And what we're trying to do here in this clam garden network, which I'll be talking about, is really kind of trying to create networks or communities of academics and non-academic knowledge holders and managers and lay people and a whole range of people. And really, I think that that is the key to kind of resilience into the future. And we're talking the theme of the whole conference is climate change, and the idea of resilience has come up a lot. And this idea of sharing knowledge, to me, is really a critical piece, I think. The Clam Garden Network was kind of added on as the title last night, when I realized really that's kind of the something that developed since I actually submitted the paper. But really, so this talk represents the knowledge of many, many people who aren't here at this conference. Just page down, Steve? Or
yes. Yeah.
The Clam Garden Network is focused on this modification of the intertidal zone that has been really compelling to archaeologists and managers and First Nations up in British Columbia. So for those of you who don't know, that's in the western part of Canada. And it's really a compelling idea to study these managed beaches because it just challenges very entrenched notions about the wilderness in British Columbia and how we should then manage and think about these ecosystems into the future. So this whole idea that beaches are wild and you have wild oceans and wild beaches, and that really wasn't peopled until Europeans came there, and not in any meaningful way anyway, because Northwest Coast peoples were passive hunters and gatherers. They did not manage their landscapes. Therefore, when we're thinking about managing into the future in the context of climate change and a whole range of other changes, we don't really need to think about traditional people's interactions with the landscape. It also, I think, there's also relevance this idea of the primacy of science. I'm working a lot with fisheries biologists, and they are one kind of culture that has been interesting to work with, and they believe very strongly in Western science, and that there's really that traditional ecological knowledge is kind of okay, but really doesn't have anything to bring to the discussion. And I would argue that really Western science has been trying to manage fisheries for a long time, and they're doing a piss poor job at it, and maybe we need to think of a whole new model. So the whole... Oh, did I offend somebody? I can do that. I'm sorry. And so I think that we want to be thinking about what we can learn from other kinds of knowledge holders and how we can manage into the future with that knowledge. So we're doing that by studying clams. Now, for those of you who know me, you know I'm a paleoethnobotanist, so don't ask. This is what I'm doing now. I'm into the intertidal, knee-deep into the intertidal. And I'm really interested in clams in this case, but I think as ethnobiologists, we know that we can replace any species in the middle of this slide. And we can think about studying the species as an avenue of getting at traditional ecological knowledge, leadership, heritage, intergenerational knowledge sharing, all these things that really make up ethnobiology. And this is really like kind of the crux of the Clam Garden Network, which brings together all these knowledge holders. And we've talked a lot today about climate change and food security, and you can see that that's kind of one of the arrows here that is of direct relevance. So, in really kind of counter to academic style, the Clam Garden Network is a bunch of people, academics and not academics, who are coming together because we love working together and we recognize the value in sharing knowledge. So instead of competing because we're working on similar stuff, we said, hey, this is awesome opportunity. So we just gathered together everybody in the province who's interested in this and said, join our club, we'll make a secret handshake, and away we go. This is Western British Columbia. For those of you who don't know, Vancouver Island, Vancouver, some of you might have been up in this region. And this is just to show you some of the places where our team is currently working. And again, we're focusing around this very compelling archaeological feature here, which is the construction of this intertidal wall. You can see these walls in all these shots here. These are all human-made walls, and they're formed by people actually rolling down the rocks from the intertidal, changing the slope of the beach by putting a terrace face in so that's flatter, thereby changing the intertidal zone at which clams grow, increasing the zone. I'll talk about that more in a second. Our team is made up of archaeologists, ecologists, traditional knowledge holders, governance people, a whole range of people, and part of it is just learning to talk to each other and finding a common language. We're conducting interviews with knowledge holders up and down the coast on clam management, and much to Departments of Fisheries and Oceans' surprise, there's a lot of deep knowledge about how these intertidal ecosystems have been managed over the long term. People are still holding knowledge on management practices, special places that are good for harvesting, places for constructing those garden walls, how clams are processed, how, of course, changes in practices in ecology today, ocean acidification, a big deal currently in my region. Yep. And one thing that's really important here, again, no surprise to ethnobiologists, the connection between this practice, clams and eating clams, and social relations. And of course, we all know the connection between biological diversity and cultural diversity. It plays out in these interviews. So this is just one of the quotes. I'll just read it to you to give you an idea of this kind of ancient management practice that people still remember. You put your small clams back in the ground and either step on it or bury it again, so we'll always have clams. Don't let the seagulls get them. If you look after it, it will come back. So cultivate our beaches. Take out the dead ones, and you can't just throw the dead ones away because they might still have seed shell in them, seedlings. If they die, you'll break a clam, but you don't throw it away. Put it back in the ground and bury it. It might have seed in it. They breathe, too, as well. When you're cultivating the soil and the ground gets too packed, they'll suffocate. So there's a lot of information in these kind of quotes about how to manage the intertidal zone. So I just want to focus very quickly on one particular place where the network is working, but we're actually repeating this kind of project up and down the coast. And it's a management nightmare, and it's just hugely fun. These are these clam garden networks in Quadra Island, one of the islands in the middle of British Columbia, coastal British Columbia. And it's showing, again, these human-made walls here, rolling down the rocks, creating this beach at the zero, this wall at the zero tide. Challenge fieldwork. These are visible 3 days a month for 4 months a year. Get a storm, you're hooped. So I keep extending my grants because I can't get into doing the fieldwork. It's terrible. This is what it looks like. In some of these bays, you know, this was an unknown archaeological phenomenon, I don't know, 8 years ago. And now look at these two bays in northern Quadra Island. The yellow dots are clam gardens, and the red dots are other terrestrial archaeological sites. They're everywhere. In this place, these people are managing, you get beaches this big, and they're building walls on them. So they're maximizing clam harvest and clam sustainability on these teeny beaches and large beaches. So it's an archaeologist's dream. I should tell you that we went here because we thought, okay, as ecologists, our ecologists were excited because then we could have, you know, replicates, and ecologists are all about replicates. But it's terrible, actually, because there's no controls. It's hard to find non-wall beaches because it's such a managed landscape. And I'm actually going to show you comparisons in the ecological realm of the walled and non-walled beaches of the very few that we could find that were non-walled. It's just some pretty maps that we made of a clam garden. Here you can see it's very flat intertidal. The wall, huge, huge archaeological shell midden. This is it from Google Maps, Google Earth. You can see those dark lines there at right angles, or not angled, but at angled, those are walls, those are human made. Can you see them up there? And this is what one of the middens looked like behind. So perfect context for doing archaeology and ecology. We asked some basic questions, our ecological team and our archaeological team and anthropological team. In comparing the few non-walled beaches that we can find, are clams bigger? Do they grow faster? Are there more of them in walled beaches, clam gardens, than non-walled beaches? And then we need to know, of course, how old are they? So this gives you a good idea of kind of what happens when you build this terrace wall. You can imagine, they fill in. If this is like optimal clam habitat in the intertidal where clams do best, hey? You can see what happens when you put a wall in. You just get more of that zone. Make sense?
Makes sense.
5 minutes till 15 minutes. I can do the math. So Amy Grosbeck, one of our wonderful master's students who is a marine ecologist, Amy spent several summers in Quadra doing these controlled experiments to try to figure out, is there differences between clam productivity in the on-walled versus walled beaches? Our Native collaborators, our First Nation collaborators said, yeah, that's where they go. The old people did this because it made it more productive, and they gave us lots of ideas why. But they said, you need to do tests so Departments of Fisheries and Oceans will believe us. You need to do the science so they'll believe what we're saying. I said, okay, so we'll do. So many of our experiments, all our hypotheses came from those discussions. So we had this hypothesis that by changing the slope, we increase the habitat of clams. And how we figured that out was by mapping just the tidal height. We just went around with an instrument and measured tidal height on various beaches. An idea that we get greater biomass, clam biomass, and just the more dense in the clam garden beaches. And we did surveys at various points up and down the beach. And that clams will grow faster and survive better. This is a critical piece to sustainability. And we did various transplant experiments. Without giving you the fancy graphs that Amy produced, is just what the results are, that in fact clam garden beaches are flatter and do increase optimal clam habitat, that they do have greater bivalve productivity, there's more biomass and they're denser, and especially important in the young. So that's important in terms of just sustainable food harvest. There's more young, more small and young individuals. They're growing faster and they're surviving better, again, especially at the young. So this is not just we're getting more habitat, but they're doing better. We need more experiments to figure out exactly why they're doing better. We have a lot of hypotheses. Is it because water is draining off less quickly here? Is it because the larvae are being retained? Is it temperature differences? Is it substrate? A lot of hypotheses and plans to figure it out. Then we turn to the archaeological piece, saying, okay, this is what it looks like today. How about into the past? So we're asking the same questions. Are the clams bigger? Do they grow faster? Are there more of them? And how old are these gardens? And now we're doing it by looking at the terrestrial middens, the clam beaches behind, where people left all the clams over the millennia. My lovely student, Nisha Puckett, who is happy as a clam. Can you be happy as a clam? Yeah, excavating one of these middens. And what we're doing is basically looking for deposits that have abundance of shell, which we're just taking in column samples. We're taking them back to the lab. No results to share yet, but what we're going to do basically is count them, speciate them, figure out what kind of species we have, look at their size, and look at their size on age. So that's critical. Again, how fast are they growing? We're good. So we look at the various rings here, and we can measure basically just like with a tree ring, what's the width between them? So how fast are they growing at any given size? So it tells us again about sustainability and productivity. This is just a messy graph to show you that we can also look at seasonality, and it shows you that people are harvesting clams throughout the year there. So that's interesting too. It means that people are surviving on these clams all the time, not just in a specific season. Next step this summer, in fact, in 4 days from now, I'm going to be doing this. in Quadra. We're going to be digging trenches in the intertidal to, if you can imagine, the infilling of that sediment in that terrace, hey, there's going to be all this sediment that's different. So this is all that filled in sediment, and this is the old beach, which is quite different. So we're going in, we got a big grant to go into clam gardens up and down the coast to dig these trenches in that hour and a half to 2 hour window that we have on those 3 days with a pump and get radiocarbon samples at trap sediment to actually figure out when these things are built. Old beach surface gets filled in, right? Follow me? You get the dates at the trapping place. So where do we go from here? Well, like I said, in 4 days we're starting this field season. We're going to be conducting more studies with other partner groups up and down the coast, more interviews. We're going to date as many gardens as possible, thanks to Werner Gren. We're really excited and really excited about the community involvement in reconstructing and deconstructing a clam garden and getting really good controlled experiments around that. And then, of course, the ultimate reason for doing this, besides it's fun and cool, is to integrate these data with current management practices, rights and title, education, and really food sustainability on our coast. Thank you.